This is the Tea on International Arbitration with Nicole Silver and Gaela Guerin-Flores. Gaela and I are practitioners in the field of international arbitration, and we are both chairs of two committees of the DC Bar International Law Community. And we're back at you with the Tea on International Arbitration, where we aim to give you bite-sized information regarding international arbitration topics of interest. It is our great pleasure to speak today in part two of our two-part series with our guest, Arif Ali. So if you haven't heard the first part, go back, listen to it, and then come back to us today.
Thanks so much for being here with us today, Arif. Now, it's wonderful to have you here. When we're considering the difference between the U.S. milieu and perspective on race and gender diversity issues versus the international perspective, I definitely tend to think of large corporations and companies in the United States that have taken a pretty aggressive stand with respect to diversity and inclusion efforts, and for instance, demand that their legal teams show and represent and show and demonstrate a true dedication to diversity and inclusion in their law firm, in their team, so on and so forth. I'm not certain that other companies or corporations around the world have shown similar sorts of commitments. I'm not certain that, the international community is particularly known for dedication to diversity and inclusion efforts in that manner of requiring legal teams, requiring your arbitrators to be diverse and inclusive. So my question to you is it realistic to expect any real advances in diversity in our field in international arbitration when international clients aren't particularly known for demanding those sorts of things? So, when we represent any given international client, it would be very rare for us to hear from them something like, I want to make sure that we appoint an arbitrator who is a woman of color, for instance, or, you're not going to hear that. So,
no, you're not. You're right. You are absolutely right. And I think that reflects the different histories and traditions and cultural, political, and social imperatives within the environment in which that company is operating. And that's a very big chunk to try and bite off, because you're sitting around the table with a company from Japan or a company from someplace. It's you're dealing with a Middle Eastern state-owned enterprise or government or what have you. I mean, they're not necessarily focused on diversity and inclusion in the way that we are, and they're dealing with their own societal barriers, which they aren't necessarily trying to overcome. I mean, that's just a reality. But I think the way in which I have the discussion with clients is to focus on what they're trying to achieve, which is victory. And in order to, and you have that conversation with them by saying that, look, you have to, this particular arbitrator is going to bring a particular perspective to the arbitral deliberations that will be far better than having, pale male stale QC, simply because somebody stuck QC after their name. I mean, it doesn't make them any better than anyone else. And why is it that you in, let's say, the Philippines or in wherever else are choosing an arbitrator who may never have been to your country, may have a difficult time in understanding the accents of your witnesses or even of your counsel, may not understand the specific issues that that your country is facing. So yeah, I think one has to have the conversation in a way that's going to speak to the specifics of the case. And that naturally then leads to thinking that results, in my experience, in a different grouping of arbitrators that the client is then willing to consider. They go beyond, you know, who's the head of which committee, or who is, you know, who's written what book, or who has, who's got, you know, various letters after their name, to actually focusing on the issues or the characteristics that will be meaningful for that case. And it inevitably leads to having greater diversity. And so I'll give you a concrete example. When we're recently going through the arbitral appointment process, and the two wing arbitrators are both women. And so in terms of discussing, you know, pitching to the client, you know, we were able to say to the client that, look, it's going to be incredibly important that you choose a team, whether it's ours or any other team, that is well represented in terms of senior female advocates. Not just the juniors who are running around, but senior female advocates are going to take the lead in terms of arguing to this particular tribunal. We need to have a chairperson who's not going to naturally try and dominate the discussion by virtue of you know, his male prerogative, but who's going to actually be open to listening to different perspectives. And we need to think about the putting forward to the other side a list of candidates that will include at least, you know, 8 women out of the 11 in the list. And so, you know, this is not something that they had thought about. And as we got deeper and deeper into the discussion, you could see that they were, you know, that they were changing in terms of their perspective from the, you know, from the list that they had come up with to the list that we were presenting and the ideas that we were presenting. But it wasn't presented in terms of morality or in terms of any type of imperative beyond that of what is going to be best for your case. And I think that those are the discussions that as we get more and more sophisticated in having them, that will then lead to, you know, will lead to change.
What's one thing that you've done to help raise awareness about diversity that you're particularly proud of?
Again, one thing is very difficult to identify, but I think perhaps stated very broadly has been the success that I've seen that mentees or people that have worked with me have achieved in the world of international arbitration. I mean, I, you know, in this respect, I, you know, I think of Sama Haridi, who is you know, going to be taking over as chair of the IBA arbitration committee and is now a very successful partner at Hogan Lovells. I mean, what an achievement to have an Arab Muslim woman who is going to be chairing the IBA committee. I mean, that's really, you know, remarkable. Or Miriam Al-Rashid, who is now the head of public international law at Eversheds, or Beju Vasani, who is now building up a very unique international arbitration practice with a Russian law firm, or Erica Franzetti, who's still my partner at Deckett. You know, to me, to see how well they're doing, obviously through their own efforts, but I think what, you know, I hope I've been able to contribute to opening doors for them, to mentoring and guiding and to giving them opportunities has been, you know, extremely fulfilling. You know, I think that, you know, at the end of the day, that's, you know, there isn't a whole lot that we're going to take away with us at the end of our days in terms of, let's say, you know, money or fame. what we're going to take away is our reputations. And if the reputation is one that's been built on helping others, then I think that is perhaps more meaningful than anything that one can do. And I should also say that, in terms of mentorship, I've had great mentors. Now, they all happen to be white men, from Andy Lowenfeld at NYU, who got me into international arbitration in the first place, to Yves Forcier, who I worked for at the UN Compensation Commission and who made a phone call to Jan Paulsen, saying you've got to hire this kid from Bangladesh, to Jan, who has helped me in so many different ways that I can't even begin to express, to Thomas Valda, Mark Baker. And so, I think that everybody takes a lot out of being able to see others succeed. So, I think that's probably, the many different things that I'm or individuals that I'm proud of.
That's really inspirational, especially at a time like this. Just to hear the notion of lifting others up with you, as opposed to kind of the vision of crabs in a bucket pulling each other down. It's great to think of that your proudest moments are lifting others up.
Well, what's going to happen is that if you pull others down, at some point they'll pull you down, right? So
yep.
I think that this is just a reality.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Kind of in that vein, a little bit. And again, this is one of my multi-part and thornier questions. So the investment treaty system has been at times criticized as just generally an extension of colonialism, and that being a system whereby the global North, in quotation marks, can have a thumb on the global South, I guess. Global capital exporters having a thumb on global capital importers, perhaps. And it's not necessarily uncommon to encounter pretty deep prejudices against developing states or entities from developing states in the investment treaty system. What is your perspective on this? What do you think when you hear criticisms like this, and you're clearly a practitioner in investment arbitration, how do you feel about that, since you're a part of that system?
Well, look, I think that the system isn't a bad system. I don't think that the system itself is the problem as such. I mean, it's a very young system. When you think about it, I mean, really, when you look at the first BIT that was in place between Pakistan and at the time West Germany, that was what, 1958, and so from 58 to where we are now in 2020, it's a very short period of time. And we think about when the ICSID Convention, which was really ingenious, was put in place, to where we are today. I mean, again, a very short period of time. So it's not the system as such, I think, that is at fault. At a very base level, the system's a good system. The foundation is a solid foundation. Any system is going to evolve. It's going to go through its valleys and peaks. I think, depending on one's perspective, we may be in a valley now, or we're coming out and we're climbing the second mountain. I'm not, sure which it is, but I think that the perspective for developing countries comes largely from the following, I think, narrative. So you, foreign investor, have come to our country and you're taking out our minerals. You're employing our people. You are contributing positively, sometimes not so positively, to our society. Your children are going to school here. We share meals in our respective homes. Some of you get married when you are, you know, here. Some of you may die here. But when it comes to a dispute, you want to go off to Geneva, Paris, London, New York, Washington, D.C., or wherever else, and have the dispute decided by three people who may know nothing about our society, our history, our issues. And that's where I think the colonial aspect embeds itself. Because I think that the decision makers aren't decision makers who are sensitive to the broader panoply of issues that should inform the dispute resolution process, and in terms of the substantive application of international law. I think that the procedures that are put in place are often those that don't, I think, reflect a true melding of legal cultures. And I think that arbitrators are too set in their ways in terms of a procedure that doesn't quite reflect the different procedural training or the different procedural perspectives of the advocates and the parties. And I think that that needs to be focused on. And I also think that there needs to be a focus on different perspectives on international law. There isn't a Western standard to which we all have to aspire and achieve. I mean, there are other perspectives on international law. There's, you know, and those are very legitimate, and they need to be given, I think, a forum within the international investment arbitration system.
Now, and you might not, you might think that this is somewhat of a logical leap, but I want to refer to an article that you wrote in July, a very powerful article advocating for the United States to provide reparations for slavery. And you made several statements that were very impactful and compelling for myself personally, and I'm sure for many others in that article, including this one. As a moral and legal matter, this is a question of providing access to justice when an entire nation is implicated in the wrongdoing, as the United States has been in its enduring legacy of racism. When an entire nation is implicated, the entire nation must provide justice. So kind of building on the sentiment of that statement, and you know, your mention that there isn't just one Western approach to resolving these disputes, there isn't just one nation involved here in the investment dispute system. So if we might admit for a moment or acknowledge for a moment that there is some white supremacy behind or inherent in the system of international arbitration. There is, you know, there are colonialist underpinnings. There's, you know, white supremacy is everywhere. And I do think that it exists in the system of international arbitration, and perhaps even more so in international investment arbitration. But in international arbitration, we're necessarily not just dealing with one nation, like we are, for instance, with the United States and its problem. It's, you know, the bloody heirloom of slavery in the United States. So if we're not dealing with one nation and an issue that's just inherent to one nation, but several, many sovereign nations, how do we deal with issues affecting the international investment system or international arbitration when they're not inherent to just one country?
I think the answer lies in the very subject matter of the questions that we've been discussing, Leila. I think that it ultimately is about diversity and participation. I mean, I think that no system can be considered legitimate by any of its participants if they don't have the ability and the opportunity to participate equally. And so I think that that's where the system, as good as it is in theory and on paper, is failing, because it doesn't allow for there isn't enough effort that's going into ensuring equal participation. I think that it's too piecemeal in terms of what's being done from the standpoint of education, from the standpoint of technical assistance, from the standpoint of, as I said earlier, institutional appointments, from the standpoint of the selection of advocates by parties from developing countries, what I call the majority world, in fact. I mean, you know, I use the term majority mainly because I don't like, you know, terms like developing or third world. I mean, I'm not third anything, and I don't feel, I may still be developing, but I don't like the what underlies the notion of, you know, you come from a developing country and you're a developing person. Yes, we all are, but not in the negative sense. So, you know, the majority of the world is economically less advantaged, but in many ways far more advantaged in when you look at other metrics of development in terms of, you know, nutrition or depression or, you know, the family unit, or in terms of societal, you know, of the social safety net. So, you know, there are different ways of looking at development. And I think that, you know, there isn't enough in terms of the advocacy that's brought to bear in these disputes that reflects those perspectives. So yes, you, I mean, you're talking about two different nations, or you're talking about the different negotiating leverage that different countries will have in the context of creating a treaty. But if you look at the new treaties today, I mean, they are reflecting questions of corruption or questions of health and safety, environmental imperatives, indigenous rights. And so I think that, again, as the system evolves and as treaty negotiators become more aware of these concepts, when I say treaty negotiators from the majority world become more aware of these concepts, they're then able to introduce them into the treaties, and ergo, then arbitrators have to take them into account as to counsel. So, you know, it, again, it's part of that evolution, but that evolution only happens if there's more work done to ensure greater inclusiveness in terms of the education, in terms of the technical assistance, in terms of arbitral appointments, you know, and everything else that we've been discussing.
Thank you.
Before I move on to what is our last question, and one which we generally ask all of our listeners to send us off with, I just wanted to say thank you so much, Arif, for this conversation. I found it very inspiring, and I, for one, think you would have done great with jury. So. But so other than what we've been talking about, which, you know, is a real issue and getting more real by the day, what is keeping you awake at night these days in our field? Is there something in particular that is really resonating with you currently in the international arbitration space?
Well, I try not to think about international arbitration late at night, unless it's a hearing or a massive brief that's due, but I, you know, Nicole, I understand the import of the question. I think what is hurting the system, and I genuinely mean this, is the lack of participation. You know, it's become so expensive that there is an issue of access to justice. And I think a lot of the expense is associated with law firm financial imperatives and the need for us to all meet certain metrics in order to satisfy the demands of, you know, whatever it is, these rankings, the financial rankings, the profit per equity partner rankings, so on and so forth. And so, you know, I don't think, I'm not saying that the system has become corrupted, but I think that we're tending to lose sight of what really is important in terms of why we are lawyers and why we are lawyering in, you know, within the context of this international system of dispute resolution. I think that there's a, if you know, I would encourage everybody to watch a video put out by the Stockholm Chamber of Commerce, I guess it's now a couple of years ago, that focuses on the generation of Karl Lagergren and Sergei Lebedev and some of the most senior arbitrators as to what they saw as being their mandate, their obligation, and their sense of service to the arbitral system. Because I think that we've lost sight of that. And with that sense of service that they all brought to the table, I think that there was a greater collegiality. I think that there was a greater sense of honor amongst advocates. I think people were more willing to concede points. I think people were more, advocates were more willing to be honorable rather than be embedded in their positions. And I think that that led to a certain sort of attractiveness to people who have a strong moral fiber and a sense of decency that I think then contributes to a far better outcome. And I think that we've lost that. And I think that can be very wearing. And the degree of intellectual and physical and moral burnout that comes with a system that continues to become, you know, continues to evolve in a way that's more aggressive is a disservice to, you know, to the participants and the users of the system. And so I think that if I think about my own practice and I think about my own aspirations, and probably what keeps me up at night is how to still be an effective advocate while, you know, ensuring that I'm being honorable, by ensuring that I'm being objective, and ensuring that I'm being kind to, you know, the people that I'm working with and the people that are on the opposite side of the table. And I think that's something that we can't lose sight of, even as we want to all give effect to our ambition, and we want to climb those rankings and we want to be those crabs that are, you know, sort of climbing over each other in the bucket. Because if we stop doing that, we will undo, I think slowly we'll start pulling out that thread and we'll destroy the system that's intended to ensure that we evolve in ways that are more positive, that create greater transparency, greater clarity in terms of the rule of law as it applies to international commerce and investment.
Thank you so much, Arif. That was amazing. So grateful to have you as a guest today. And also thankful for the DC Bar. Please, if you want to check out more about what DC Bar communities have to offer, please visit dcbar.org/communities. You've been listening to The Tea on International Arbitration with Nicole Silver and Gaela Gehring Flores and our guest, Arif Ali. Watch out for new episodes. And if you liked this episode, please tell a friend about it and subscribe at anchor.fm/dcbartea or anywhere you access your podcasts.